Oh, hi. It's Dave from before. Dave Hill from Show Business. Yes, that Dave Hill, the one from the news. And today on the show, comedian, writer, actor, and podcast host, Paul Scheer. From What We Do in the Shadows, James Dwyer. Plus, as if that's not enough, Andrew Lynn. It's The Novelizers. I'm your host, Dave Hill, and welcome to The Novelizers, the podcast where comedy writers take super dreary movies like The Dark Knight and rewrite them with jokes. Then we get your favorite comedians and actors to narrate. Today's episode is narrated by SAG Award-winning actor and comedian known for The League, Black Monday, Veep, and he's the co-host of what I believe to be one of the greatest podcasts of all time. How Did This Get Made? Please welcome Paul Scheer.
Dave, I am thrilled to be here, and I'm realizing, have you ever done How Did This Get Made?
No, I would love to.
Well, that to me, just like, I was like, well, of course you've done it. And then I was like, I don't think he has. And then I really revealed a lot of myself by asking that question because I was being vulnerable because I was like, I can't imagine a world where we haven't had Dave on the show. And and there it is. So get ready. You're going to get an email from us. We don't really do guests anymore, but you're podcast royalty. You're all royalty. So I feel like that's a shocking omission in our catalog of amazing guests.
I would love it. I'm elusive. That's why I haven't.
That is
done
true.
It yet. I'm elusive.
Yeah, you're elusive.
And unknowable, according to those closest to me.
And that's always a good place to be, honestly. The more we can keep people at bay, not knowing where we are, what we're thinking, it only turns out good for personal relationships across the board.
But with humans and dogs, I find those things to be true.
Cats, too.
More so than either of those other things. Where are you now? Are you in Hollywood?
I'm in California? What they call Lipstick City, Hollywood, California. where the entertainment industry is thriving. I mean, you can't drive down the block without multiple sitcoms being taped, and that's interesting because there's no room on the stages. They're actually shooting multi-cam sitcoms in people's houses now. We're back, baby. We're back.
Better than ever. I realize you're probably not technically in Hollywood is just to give this show the wow factor.
Yeah, no. I'm more in the I love LA world. If you're familiar with the HBO show I Love LA, that's kind of the part of LA I live in, the east side, the cool side. To me, I did move to LA and lived in Hollywood. Right down the block from the Mann's Chinese Theater, where you could, put your hands in Marilyn Monroe's hands or be attacked by a little man dressed as Chucky. It's a great history there.
Is that Hollywood Boulevard? Is that where
that is? Hollywood and Highland. And here's the thing. For many years, you would think, Hollywood and Highland, that's where it happens in Hollywood. No, for the longest time, and I would still say, ultimately, there's not much there. It's a corner that if you drive just a little bit north, you get on the highway. And to the left of it, there are some cool things. Now I believe there's a giant gap on that corner or some sort of clothing store.
Is there, am I getting this wrong? Isn't there like a Days Inn or a Best Western right around there?
You know, there's a bar that's very famous called like Smog Cutter there. Oh. And there's also, I believe, near Smog Cutter, a hotel that doesn't look like, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes, up the road. Yes, there is a Days Inn on probably the busiest thoroughfare in, I would say, all of Hollywood and maybe even LA, because it's everyone getting off the 101. So if you were to ever come here and visit and rent a car, it would be a nightmare to get back to your hotel or to leave your hotel. It would give you'd be like, I hate LA. I can't, I've never could drive here.
Well, my first time going to LA for general meetings, which to my, you know, this was 2007, and I thought every one of these meetings was going to be someone offering me $1 million.
Well, and in a weird way, they are dangling that, but then they never make the follow-up phone call. Like, the idea is like, we see the future. We know what's going on. Let's swing back. And you always assume, well, that's when we're going to get into it. And then really what you realize is you just walked away with a bottle of water.
Yeah, exactly. And as so when I went out there, I was like, this is big time. I'm not staying with friends this time. I'm going to get myself a proper hotel. I think the first time in my life I did this, I was like, this is the big time, Dave. And I booked myself a room at the Days Inn that we were right just there. Referring to. And
well, I okay. Went, oh, my God. That must have been, how was it? What did you feel?
Oh, my
feel?
God.
What
it was see? Horrifying. It was like, I went in, I mean, I do this in virtually every hotel, regardless of what kind of, I peeled back the top blanket or whatever, and there was a big, about a foot and a half in diameter, a yellow stain on the sheets. And I remember thinking like, well, I need to know. I feel like, because I was like, well, I have to go. I'm going to complain to the manager. And I thought I need to confirm whether it's fresh or not, just for when I talk to the manager.
Right.
And I actually, because I trust in my immune system and all that. So I touched it to be like, confirm whether it was damp. Because I was like, well, I can just wash my hands. And I felt okay with that. Anyway, I digress. But that stretch of...
Was it damp? You can't leave me hanging.
It was damp. It was damp.
Oh, my Lord.
To their credit, they moved me to another equally disgusting room. But that area, though, that you talk about in Hollywood with the man's Chinese theater, like, I remember, I think it's kind of why I've always, and I admit to being, I think when you really peel back the layers, just afraid to have ever, I think I've always been afraid to move to LA when you really get past everything. And because I remember standing out there on Hollywood Boulevard, and I had gone to a taping of the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
Amazing.
And I looked and I saw there was like a guy in a Spider-Man costume. And then, like, it was a nice one. Like, he'd spent the extra
$50.
And then there was a guy, like, 30 feet away in another Spider-Man costume that was, like, really raggedy and stuff. And I was like, I saw the one guy. I'm like, that's me in 6 months, and that's me in a year if I move here. Like, deep down in my, you know, in my scariest little place inside. Well, anyway,
you
know,
this is actually interesting you bring this up, because I am a New Yorker. I grew up in Long Island. My dad lives in Queens. I have been a New Yorker for many parts of my life. I still have a 917 number. Like, New York is very much a me thing. But now I believe I've been in Los Angeles longer than I've been in New York. And what I will say is, you don't belong in LA, and not because you are nothing about your personality, but you are, to me, a quintessential New Yorker. You can't put Batman in Metropolis. You can't put Superman in Gotham. It just doesn't work. And to me, it's like, you should visit and you should take advantage of everything that is to offer you. But to me, you're one of those people, when I look, I'm like, this is what you want. This is the cool New York vibe. There's a thing about you that I feel like you seem educated, you're well-rounded, you play music, you're facile at everything, you're funny,
you're very kind.
Smart, you know, it's like, I could see you very at home in any kind of a setting, which is, I think, a perfect place to be in New York.
Oh, thank you. Well, likewise. I was thinking, in anticipation of this recording, that you were the first person I ever knew to be a guest on Letterman.
Oh, my God.
Talking about Human Highlight. Giant.
Highlight.
And I was like, Paul did it. Because growing up, that would be the coolest thing that anyone could achieve.
It, and I was honestly, like, when I look back in my like career, you know, hopefully it's still going. When I look back, I go like, that is such a highlight because he was such an influential person to me. I was taping Letterman during the week and watching it because I couldn't stay up that late. Not because my parents, but I just was not built for that at that point. Now no problem. But I love Letterman. And to go out there, this is what I'll tell you. Can I sidetrack for a second and tell you
Please.
This Letterman story?
I just told you that Days In story. You're owed 20 sidetracks after that.
Obviously, it was big. It was not only going on Letterman, but it was the first time I'd ever gone on a talk show. So here's what they don't tell you, that there's a pre-interview, right? I didn't know this. I was naive. I didn't understand. I thought people came, they started doing a bit, it was funny, and they left. I didn't understand that even, you know, the highest to the lowest, they know what they're doing on some level. So I get this phone call from like the producer, and the producer's like, hey, let's talk. And we're talking, and I'm telling them these things. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, this is good, because he's just getting like ideas of where Dave can kind of interact with me.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. I get to the Ed Sullivan Theater, which I lived across the street from. I lived up on 50th and 8th, and I used to make the Stangles, who used to be the head writers of Letterman. We used to put things out of our windows to kind of communicate to each other, little flags and stuff. So that was before it was right. I lived like on one side of Roseland, and the Letterman building was on the other side.
Oh,
so, all this to say, I get there, and then I get this 15-page document where they have taken our conversation that we had earlier, compacted it, and made me, you know, more interesting and better. Then, you know, they took all my stories, all my ramblings, and just kind of cinched it up. And they go, okay, here it is. This is the interview. He's going to say this. You're going to say this. He's going to say that. You're going to say this. And I'm looking at a script of my own stories. And I'm like, oh my God. And I'm trying to commit this to memory. I'm like, because again, I am not super familiar, but now I feel more pressure because he's going to ask me this and he's going to ask me that. And they go, he's going to ask you these three questions. If he likes you, he might ask you another one or two. So you know the three will be there, but don't think the four and five are not given. So I was like, oh my God. Now the first guest of that night went long. And I was like, well, three questions it is for me. Then I came out, he asked all five. I was thrilled. In the edit of the show, the first guest was cut down. I got some more time. But what was so fun about it was I was out there, I was nervous. So much stuff was going on. I'm talking to Dave. But very much like every Norm Macdonald sketch or everything you've seen in any documentary about Dave Letterman, the minute it was like, okay, Paul Scheer, ladies and gentlemen, head down, turned away, no engagement. And I didn't know what to do, you know. And I'm always a person mm-hmm. who's like, I offered. I'm like, can I stay on the couch and watch the musical act? They're like, no. I was like, okay, you know, so that was it. It was a thrill. It was awesome. I loved it. And I was asked back. I'm bumped. But it was nothing beat that.
Yeah, I remember it well. And I think if I remember, you gave a shout out to your dad in the balcony.
My mom and dad were there. My mom clapped so hard that her wedding ring shot off her finger. And like had to stay at the end of the show to find it under one of the seats.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing! See, this is
it was really fun. But yeah, it was fun to it was really fun, and it was just, you know, I love those moments, and I still find them where you realize just how naive you are about certain things, like I never understood the way talk shows worked. You know, I just didn't. And that's the one was crazy. And to feel like you're messing up, but you're also like, but I'm also like, how can I mess up? This is my own stories. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it also instilled in me this idea that like you have to deliver on one of these shows. Like you have, like we all can't be Albert Brooks. You know, I've tried to pitch ideas and, you know, it's like, it's hard to sometimes get ideas through. Like the bit I had that I really have been dying to do, well, I won't do it now, but is I've always wanted to come out on one of those shows with a full wig and not acknowledge that I am now not bald. and people are like, I don't know. I'm like, it would be funny.
Well, like,
but yeah.
I feel like we don't see, like, that would be something. I feel like when you and I were, and you too, Stephen, to a lesser extent, I feel like you're just a kid. But,
an old, old.
But, kid. Like, growing up, like, they would have, like, you know, Harvey Pekar and, like, Brother yeah. Theodore and, like, stuff that I can't fathom happening really today, where, like, a weird thing could be allowed to breathe that much.
And the, what was interesting about 1230 was it truly was treated like, I think when you look back at like the history of Saturday Night Live, right, they were the not ready for primetime players. And to me, what I loved about that idea was like, oh yeah, these are people that we can't put in primetime for however they looked, however they acted. And now obviously that's we can't be further from that. But
yeah.
That's what 1230 was, right? It was like, these aren't Carson would never have Harvey Pekar on. And when Letterman did have like a bigger guest, a name, you know, it was like, you know, Bill Murray, but Bill Murray was kind of in the building. And maybe at that point, it wasn't that successful. But it was like, yeah, you could have Jerry Lawler and Andy Kaufman to do like two segments, or like Crispin Glover to show karate. It was like, it was the Freaks and Geeks Hour, which I thought was like the coolest thing about the 1230 slot. But then the 1230 slot just became an extension of the 1130 slot. And then they both kind of merged. The only difference being that like Conan, I think, always kept the sensibility of Letterman, even though the guests were upgraded.
Yeah. It was just always such like that's like to your earlier point about like the interviews. I think my whole notion of because of Letterman was like, I was like, it didn't occur to me like, oh, Letterman was a stand-up. He wrote for Good Times. He did all this stuff. I was just like, he probably was friends with some guy that worked at NBC and they went to high school together. And he's like, let's get Dave. He was funny back in the... And then, like, Chris Elliott, like how, you know, like I just thought like, oh, like these guys were just like, we got to put something on, you know.
And you're not ultimately wrong, because I think like obviously then you look at Jimmy Fallon, like, well, what's Jimmy Fallon? Well, Jimmy is Lauren's guy and Lauren took over the Tonight Show. So he put Jimmy there. And then who else did he put there? Well, you know, he put, a late night. Sorry. It was like when he took over, it's like they put in, you know, Higgins, you know, it's like there is a little bit of not nepotism, but like, oh, who you know. And that this is like, I think our whole career is just like always hopefully leave a good trail behind you, because you never know where that will kind of snake back and forth. It's, you know, I think it always bears repeating, like burning bridges may feel good in the moment, but they very rarely ever equate to something that you are happy with.
Yeah, it's never like, I'm so glad I told all those people to fuck off.
Yeah, just doesn't. Because the other part of it too is like, you will have your height, your high highs. And when you hit that low, people will not put a hand out to help you. They will watch you fall happily. And look, I have not said to people, fuck you, but there are certain ways I've handled myself in my entire career. And I can probably count them on one hand where I'm like, I wouldn't do that now. I'd be smarter about that now, but you have to sometimes make mistakes too. But I always feel like, don't make those mistakes with your friends. You can make them with executives a little bit. But your friends are going to be the ones that are going to come back and hire you or look out for you or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is that weird, like life is high school as much as...
I know.
You
as
don't
much as we all
to
try
be.
To escape it.
Yeah, and then also the other one, I think about this, you know, like when you're a kid, and this is, I'm digressing, but you know, things, embarrassing things happen, you know, when you're in school, grade school and things like, and when you're a kid, they always say like, don't worry, no one's ever going to remember that. It's never going to come up. I'm like, no, I literally remember everyone who wet their pants, everyone that puked. I have empathy. I'm not making fun of them in my head, but I'm like, I do remember it. I didn't forget.
It's, you know, it's funny you say it because I have a similar thing where I will often lay in bed and, you know, and just be like, man, when I was at the CVS today and I said this, I shouldn't have, I said, she must've thought I was weird. You know, like I am running through like those defending your life moments, like not even defending your life, but I'm just like running through like from 4 years ago when I parallel parked and it looked like I stole that guy's space and he gave me the angriest face. I'm like, I guess I really did fuck up. Like I carry that, you know, I and it's like those moments that you're just like, all right, yeah. And it's not like, I think at a certain point, like I heard, I think Kevin Smith is always fascinating to listen to as far as like a storyteller. And, you know, he was talking about this thing and it really is important to be like, you cannot change that past. You cannot affect that future. He's saying something that we always say, but he just had this really great way of just being like, you just got to be in the now. And it's so easy, I think, also for us to be so caught up in it, because I'm often like, what would happen if I did that? You know, like I don't know if you've had these moments where it's probably really revealing for me. Like I'll hear something terrible and I'll be like, huh, what would happen if that was me? Like, I really want to like, I see myself in that situation and I'm like, this is not something to envy. It's not like, oh, that person got this amazing job or that person has tremendous success. Like, oh, this person had something awful happen to them. Let me really deep dive and like try to live in those shoes for a second. I'm like, I don't know what that instinct is, but I feel like it's like we're constantly seeking to unpack everything. Like, how would I react? What would I have done different? You know, maybe that's a good thing that to remember the peers and the pukers of our youth. Because I think it is about like what fuels us now too.
Yeah. It's a weird, and it's always nice to hear, you know, hear you say that and hear different people. Like for years, I would always be, I truly thought I was the only person on earth who had that feeling of like when you're at dinner and you're like, what if I just stab them in their hand with a fork? Yeah. And it wasn't until I really started like in my early 20s and started seeing a therapist and stuff when I'm like, oh, I thought it was just me.
Well, you know, it's so funny. All the stuff that we, you know, start to put in our heads. It's good, you know, but here's the thing I heard recently that I'm fascinated by. Some people don't have that inner voice. Like there's no, I don't know how you are, but like I hear there's a voice that I, like, it's not like a little girl. It's not a big gorilla. It's just, it's my voice, but I'm like, I'm having conversations in my head a little bit, you know, not, you know, and some people just don't have that. And that's really interesting to me. I don't even understand how that works, but I understand. It's like, oh no, they say the thing that they were thinking. Meanwhile, I'm like, poop, 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 you know, if I have a couple minutes by myself, you know.
Well, I think that's why you dress up as Batman, so you can just go and stab that person with the fork, then change back.
I think you're right, but you know, like there is something about this idea. Like I you know, thinking about Batman.
Are you a Dark Knight fan?
I am.
The,
I mean,
the original.
You know, to me, it's I mean, like not in a way that would be like make you feel uncomfortable at a party, but
stop talking about the Dark Knight.
Yeah, I feel like men who like Batman are problematic. Like, and I don't say that like I love Batman. I enjoy Batman. I'm reading the Scott Snyder Batman right now. But if you wear it as part of your personality, it does to me speak about a larger issue that you might have. Like, I'm actually less scared of guys who rock the Punisher logo because I'm like, well, I get where you're coming from. And I have made my own assumptions. But the Batman thing feels like there's a lot more depression and anger going on. It's not as forefronted as
You're like, there's a lot of half-eaten bowls of cereal back at home that are still out on the
counter. Yeah, there's a lot of like, God damn it, if I had my way, I would have gone in there. Like, it does feel, it feels like, you know, there is something, look, something very similar about the Joker and Batman. And I think it's a very fine line. Yeah. And, that's what this, obviously, what that movie, I think, does a great job doing. But I think the novelization really hammers home. Like, Batman is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde to a certain degree, right? It's like, oh, what if I was not the kind surgeon and I used everything I knew to actually be a fucking monster, right? Like, we are, like, that is the root of it. Like, how can I be two people, one good, one bad? And Batman is, like, obviously, you know, good, bad is like a very fine line, but I'm just saying, like, but one out there using my fists, one out there using my wits. And, you know, like however that Batman is portrayed, especially in Dark Knight, he's kind of like more of an asshole-y rich guy, but he's not necessarily bad. He's just kind of viewed as like dumb, right? And lazy. But that idea of like underneath the surface, you can actually be this. It's kind of like acting out the two sides of your personality, right? Yeah, like just being able to live in both worlds.
Yeah, and finding that balance, and also knowing which one's crazy at which any given time.
Well, right, but I think it's like we all are, that's the other thing too, is like we all are a little bit crazy, and we live by our own rules. Ultimately, right? In the sense that, yes, there are rules of society. There are many people who do not abide by those rules. And they are then treated, by society as people who cannot conform to those rules. So you have to be now put away or whatever, in whatever way that is, or, you know. So I do think that there is a constant balancing act that people are having about like, oh, why couldn't I do this? Why won't I do this? Like, you know, but it's like, oh, you've agreed to a set of rules of how to behave. And I feel like that at some level, I mean, this is not something I'm like made a thesis on, but it's like you are conforming to something, yeah, like whatever it is, like, you know, and if you don't, you're viewed as weird.
Or you're elected president.
Yes. Well, there's the hey, look, I think we got to give this guy a chance.
Oh boy.
In the immortal words of Dave Chappelle, give him a chance.
Paul, thank you. It's so great to see you, first of all, and thanks for joining us.
I loved being a part of this. The show rules, and I cannot wait to reach out to you to have you on How Did This Get Made?
Please, I insist.
And we should have Dave. We should have Dave on too.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you have to say. Yeah, we'll get.
Wow. Thank you, Paul Scheer. The show is not over. Not over with that intro banter.
Not by a long shot, sister.
No. We've got some other people on the show. Who are they?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Stephen. James Dwyer is an actor and comic who's appeared on What We Do in the Shadows and performs regularly at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York City. You can catch him there in Ask Cat, or hosting his monthly variety show, The Great American Shit Carnival. We've also got Andrew Lin. He's a writer and cartoonist behind the massively successful Mountain of Sadness comics. Check him out at mountainofsadness.blogspot.com.
What a lineup. And what is happening in this week's episode?
I'm glad you asked, Stephen. This time around, the Joker infiltrates Bruce's fundraiser for Harvey, and although he makes an attempt on Rachel's life, he is thwarted by Batman.
Damn you, Batman.
Yeah, so irritated with Batman. I would be so irritated
with
Batman if I were, the Joker.
Paul Scheer. Novelize us.
The Novelizers presents The Dark Knight, Chapter 10. I love Batman. Novelized by Andrew Lin, narrated by Paul Scheer. First, do you even know who Batman is? Because none of this is going to make any sense if you don't know who Batman is. He's a superhero who wears a costume that is the same color as a bat and, much like the Knights of Yore, fights crime. For these two reasons, he's often referred to as the Dark Knight. Now, the next thing that you need to know about Batman is I love Batman. I love him. I love him so much that every night I brush my teeth with a Batman toothbrush, put on my Batman pajamas, get into my Batman bed, turn off my Batman light, and fall into a Batman sleep, dreaming of midnight black stallions galloping off into the night dressed like Batman. I love him so much, I named all my children after him and only refer to them by number. I love him so much that as a kid, it put some weird sexual ideas in my head that would eventually be validated and massively exacerbated by the internet. I mean, I love him so much that I don't wear my Batman costume to be Batman, but to be inside Batman. Not in a weird way. I mean, more like the costume itself is Batman, and I'm like his sidekick Robin, supporting him. But from the inside, you know, like kind of like a skeleton, and he needs me because he's too floppy to stand and move around by himself. Also, when I close my eyes, he talks to me quietly, voice low and hoarse, sticky, with mouth sounds. That's how much I love Batman. Now, like all Batman fans, I love the Joker even more. Who's the Joker? That's a stupid question. I almost can't believe that you're asking me that. I mean, the question makes me want to slam my face into a pillow and scream. I mean, that question makes me want to wordlessly turn and walk into the ocean. That question makes me want to put on my Batman costume, climb into my Batwing fighter jet, and just fuck off to Gotham City, the one place where no one is going to ask me that question. Find me three people who don't know who the Joker is, and I'll give you two words. Triple homicide. To make things as clear as possible, the Joker is who I think about when I'm fucking Batman. And if I lose myself in the passion and accidentally say his name and Batman hears me, it's fine. He's already cry-fucking and calling me Rachel. I mean, just sobbing and screaming her name. Oh, Rachel. Oh, Jesus, Rachel. Now I'm crying too. It's really poignant and hot. I should also add that the Joker is kind of a comedy-slash-clown-based villain who steals things and murders people. If that wasn't enough to convince you how awesome the Batman and the Joker are, I get it. You need to see them in action. And I respect that. And I meet your challenge. So, settle down and listen. A little while ago, billionaire Bruce Wayne was throwing a party. Bruce Wayne parties never go well, so everyone had shown up. It was a fancy pants affair in a penthouse so huge, it looked like the kind of place that other penthouses would go to hang out. Now the room was packed with Gotham elite, their skin pumped so tight with generational wealth you could pop it with a pin. Rich fucks. There were trophy wives, trophy husbands, and couples so gorgeous that only their accountants could tell which one was the trophy. The event they had all gathered for was a political fundraiser. Bruce had called in all his wealthiest buddies to raise funds for Harvey Dent, so Dent could buy himself a permanent position as Gotham's district attorney. But the truth was, this was just a flex to win over Rachel, Bruce's puppy love since birth. Right now, Rachel was dating Harvey, and Bruce had hit on the bad idea that he could impress her by helping Harvey out. That idea being to both show off his astonishing magnanimity and remind her how super rich he was. Unfortunately, it was never going to work. I mean, when it came to Bruce, the gauge of Rachel's heart was an arrow pointed straight at disappointment. And it was because of exactly this kind of shit. Once the party was in full swing, Harvey Dent was supposed to dodge and weave through this crowd, glad-handing his way to the golden heart of the Gotham ruling class. Instead, he took Bruce's bait and went looking for Rachel, hoping to counter Bruce's cash-rich strategy with his soft boy energy. He opened with some off-putting romantic mewing and then basically dared her to marry him, hoping to confuse her into saying yes. This was as bad as an idea as Bruce's. Now, Rachel was trying to, you know, phase through the folds of space and vanish from the conversation when Bruce suddenly appeared, grabbed Harvey by the neck, and choked him out. Rachel probably took this as yet another attempt by Bruce to win her over in a sort of Popeye versus Bluto move, but that's not what was going on at all. You see, Bruce Wayne and Batman are actually the same guy. Take a moment for that to sink in. It turns out that this wasn't a billionaire party at all. It was a Batman party, and the only problem was that Bruce was still dressed up like himself. He needed to run and put on the Batman costume, and he told Rachel to do whatever and then took off. Bruce Wayne might be a fool for love, but Batman, he's got no time for that. The reason Harvey needed to be choked half to death and stuffed in a closet was for his own good. The goddamn Joker. Remember him? He had just busted into the party looking for Harvey, and the penthouse had so many closets it would take hours for him to be found. Now, the Joker had just emerged from the private elevator, clowned up and ready to dance. To be honest, he didn't look great. He couldn't take off his ratty purple overcoat. It was kind of his trademark, and he would have looked weird without it. So now he just kind of sweated off half his clown makeup, and his cheap green hair dye was just starting to run. I mean, he looked like a day-old party balloon. He made it work, though. Confidence is key. And the Joker was nothing if not confident. I mean, this crowd parted respectfully in awe as he strode directly to the center of the room. Half the people already planning to cop the look the next day. The Joker warmed up the room with some on-brand antics, you know, talking like a maniac and acting silly. Then he got down to business. He demanded that Harvey step forward to be murdered. And at that point, he lost the room. I mean, the crowd wasn't having it, especially Rachel, who had rejoined the party instead of getting into the closet with Harvey. I mean, she was worried that he would wake up and misread the situation. She called out to the Joker, "Hey, you, stop it." The Joker looked over, caught on quick, realizing Rachel was Harvey's girlfriend, or maybe he already knew, unclear. He got up in Rachel's face and started simping like a bad date, going straight into a sob story about his ex-wife. I mean, the Joker instantly had a thing for Rachel. He thought he'd try the sad psychopath approach. Believe it or not, it sometimes worked. The story he told was about the scars he had on his face. He said he used to be a normal, cool guy with a cool wife, and they were super happy together. But then she got a little too much into online sports betting, and the mob came after her. Fortunately, she asked if they could just, like, wait a little bit, and they were totally chill about it. Joker did a couple extra shifts at Clown Factory, and everything just turned out fine for a while. Then one night, she made a fatal mistake and accidentally washed her face with body wash, leaving her skin dry and kind of tight feeling. Now, the Joker heard the screams coming from the bathroom and ran over. She was inconsolable. He tried to make her feel better by shaving his face with one of her leg razors, which predictably left him with an enormous gash across his entire face. Either injury would have been enough to end the marriage, but the two together shattered his sanity. Rachel was not impressed. She gave the Joker a punch, just knocking him back, then squared up for one of her grade A cutdowns. But before she could come up with one, Batman suddenly appeared from out of frame to give the Joker a punch of his own, sending that silly goof into a kooky pratfall. But Batman forgot that the room was also full of the Joker's goons, who dove right in and started punching. Everyone was punching everybody. Wanting everyone to calm the fuck down, the Joker pulled out his gun and shot out the penthouse window. Then he took Rachel and dangled her out over the city streets. Batman saw this and was immediately super pissed. Dangling people in the air was his signature shtick. He was still trying to figure out what kind of punch he should do to save her when the Joker suddenly let go and she fell screaming out the window. Batman went through the window himself, also screaming. He was able to save Rachel by grabbing her and falling slower. The two went crashing onto a parked car completely unharmed. Classic. Now this left the Joker still up in Bruce's penthouse with his pack of murderous henchmen. Fortunately, the penthouse was also full of billionaires. While Batman and Joker were slugging it out, the party had quietly emptied itself as all the billionaires slipped away to change into their own Batman costumes. It was a tricky maneuver because none of the Batmans could let the other Batmans know that they were Batman. They somehow made it work, and each Batman came storming back into the party, fist first, ready to punch. The Joker turned around to find himself confronted with an entire room full of deeply confused Batmans, slugging it out as each of them tried to figure out who all these other Batmans were, or if, in fact, even they were the Batmans they thought they were. The Joker, forgotten, slipped away into the chill of the Gotham night.
Thank you, Paul. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. Every week on The Novelizers, we talk to someone who actually worked on the film The Dark Knight. This week, our own Kevin Carter was in New York to interview the monologue coach for the film. I don't even know what that means. Guess we'll find out.
I'm here with James Dwyer, who was the monologue coach for The Dark Knight. James, how's it going today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I've been loving New York City, and I wish I could live here for 3 days. That's all I got. I can't do no more than 3 days.
It's a lot.
That's it.
It's
72 hours is all you're getting out of me, and I need fresh air. So, monologue coach, can you give the audience a little more detail about what it is you did?
Yeah, monologue coach. So basically, you know, when you're an actor on set, sometimes you have a role where you have to prepare, obviously, a monologue. And on The Dark Knight, Heath Ledger in particular had a lot of big, dramatic speeches that he gave.
Yes.
I think some of the most famous ones you might be familiar with are, "Do you want to know how I got these scars?"
Mm-hmm.
He gave two in particular that they weren't easy for Heath, to be honest, as originally written. So they brought me in. He was struggling with those.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and part of the issue was the writing wasn't quite there.
Okay.
And when that happens, they bring in a monologue coach like me, and I help with the script, I help with the writing so that the actor can get on the same page, and I helped with the performance.
See, okay, that's the big one, because I think the performance is very key when it comes to giving a good monologue.
And I do take full credit for what he did.
You take full credit?
And I take full
Not
credit.
Even...
And I take
all of you take all the credit. Okay.
And I take full credit.
Okay.
And I take full
credit. So how was he before you got there? How was his monologues looking?
Apparently they'd been trying to film. So the first scene where he's talking about do you want to know how I got these scars?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they've been trying to film that scene for about a month.
Wow.
That scene took a month.
That's quite a budget.
Yeah. Well, they had a lot of money.
Yeah.
They had money to burn.
Mm-hmm.
Chrissy Nolan, I call him Chrissy.
Mm-hmm.
Batman Begins was such a hit.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him a long runway. And, you know, the studio was starting to get upset.
Mm-hmm.
Heath was, you know, deep in the role. He's Joker on set every day. He was doing his thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he trusted me. We went way back. I was his monologue coach on A Knight's Tale also.
Okay, I remember that movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was also his monologue coach on A Knight's Tale.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't really too many monologues on A Knight's Tale, but I did help him out a little bit here and there. On A Knight's Tale. And they brought me in after a month. I came in. We reworked that whole monologue from scratch.
Okay.
We came up. We started riffing. We said, where do we think these scars came from? And I said, I don't know. Maybe it's like your daddy. Maybe your daddy's a freak. Maybe daddy's a little drunk. Maybe daddy be cutting up your lips, your face, giving you these scars. Maybe you got a sad wife. Maybe wifey's sad. And that's how so whenever I was his monologue coach, I sort of took on this character and I called him Little Jokey. So, because he was always in character on set Joker.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was his monologue coach, my name was Little Jokey.
Okay.
And so when I'm Little Jokey, I'd be like, yeah. Like I had that kind of voice. I'm like, daddy said that maybe he's a little too drunk today. And then he's going to cut up your face. And so that's how we got there. It was a lot of back and forth before we finally got there. And again, it's two different stories, as you saw in the movie. And we finally landed on, you know, the first story being that he had a drunk alcoholic father.
Yeah. And I think what was so good about those monologues were they were two completely different stories on how he got the scars.
And
right?
It wasn't supposed to be that way.
It wasn't.
No, it was supposed to be him telling the exact same story again. But when it came down to it, when we were recording the second story, second narration, he said it didn't feel right.
Yeah.
And then, so, you know, we stalled out. I'm on set at this point, and I had to go back into Little Jokey mode. So here I am as Little Jokey on set.
Yeah.
I'm going, oh, maybe I'm the wifey now. And then I go into little wifey mode. Mm-hmm. And little wifey. And I say, I'm sad, Joker. And then so little wifey said, so it was a whole thing. We cooked up a whole scenario.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was addicted to pills as little wifey.
Like not, the character, your character?
Yeah, I developed the whole
you
story.
Was addicted to pills.
Oh, well, separately, I was addicted to pills.
Okay,
but
gotcha.
I don't want to get into that.
Let's not, you know,
we could scrub that.
Yeah, we can go and redact that from the edit.
But little wifey was addicted to pills, sugar mm-hmm, pills, mm-hmm. but pills nonetheless.
Yes.
And, cause she was a real sad sort.
Mm-hmm.
And, we found it eventually.
Okay.
Yeah. That was his only way in.
Yeah,
we got it.
That's good. That's good. And like I said, it's just a powerful thing. That monologues, both of them, they make the movie. You know what I'm saying?
It's amazing.
And like before he changed it, mm-hmm. before he changed the second monologue, which is completely different about the wifey, right? That first one, you thought that was the one, right?
Yeah.
And at that moment, you felt sorry for him because it's like, man, your life is bad. And then he said, the other one, you're just a lying son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I thought you was, you know what I'm saying, like really sad out here. You're maniacal, you know?
And it ended up working out. You mm-hmm. know, it kind of shows you the texture to this character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It turns out the Joker maybe is actually a bad guy.
Yes.
Which maybe, I don't know for you, but I've been watching that movie, the first 2/3 of that movie. I thought, is the Joker a good guy?
I mean, he gave a very, very small Robin Hood complex.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Hello, Robin.
He's robbing a bank to begin with.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
we don't know where that money's going.
Exactly. I mean, we thought it was going to be for all the team. It wasn't that because maybe he was giving it to somebody else that needed it more.
Right.
You know? So.
And, you know, the guy, he puts the pencil through the guy's eye. That guy's mm-hmm. a bad guy.
Yeah, he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah. And he kind of like backstabbed all the bad people.
Yeah.
Right. He got all the bad people to get him back. He might be a hero. We don't give him enough credit for that.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
When you think of a blanket monologue like this, regardless of what's said, regardless who said it, this is a monologue.
Mm.
And you need this thing to be Oscar worthy. What is the one key component you need in that monologue?
Loud volume. It has to be loud.
You got to be loud. Okay.
Yeah. And so that was something I struggled with actually with Heath because he didn't believe in that.
Yeah.
He thought that it should be brooding and sort of slow played it. And so we went back and forth on that. And ultimately he kind of won out,
mm-hmm.
as you see in the film. And to this day, I am a little bit pissed about that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's loud. And that's my two cents. But, you know, okay. I went to Mason Gross. That's what I learned.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I learned.
Yeah. Let's have some fun. We're having some fun.
Yeah. Please. I love fun.
I'm going to ask you two questions.
Please.
The first question, I'm sure the audience would like you to answer the question as if you're giving a monologue.
Mm.
Just you. Just like an Oscar-worthy monologue.
I would love
the
that.
The second question, I want you to give the monologue as little jokey.
Okay.
just the... show the contrast, if that's okay.
That's great. I love that. Because one is me doing the monologue, and one is me as the person helping someone get into monologue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You mean the character of the character
type
thing.
Yeah, the character
thing.
Of the character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
So what is your most memorable monologue that you haven't done, that one you saw, and you was like, I want to get into doing this? Like, what was your inspiration? That first monologue, that was your inspiration to do what you do?
What's the first monologue that inspired me to want to be a monologue coach? The movie Network. You know, the one where he's like yelling and stuff. So that one, that's my monologue.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's a short monologue.
Yeah.
That was a short monologue.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's that.
That's that. Okay.
So not every monologue's long.
But it's got to be loud.
Yeah. It's loud. Yeah. We'll see how that comes out. It might be blown out, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it'll work. Yeah. I think it'll work.
Yeah.
So the next one, as a little jokey.
Yeah, please.
When was the first time you thought to yourself, I could make a living off this? Like, I could do this for the rest of my life and be good.
Well, probably when Daniel Day-Lewis wanted me to work with him on his milkshake monologue.
What movie was that, milkshake monologue?
There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
I drink your milkshake. Come on, Danny Day.
Now, you might notice that the voice sounds a little different this time when I did Lil Jokey, and that's because I can't remember what I was doing about a couple minutes ago. And that's because right before I got here, I did probably about 5 whippets. I'm not addicted to pills anymore, but I am addicted to whippets.
Okay. Yeah. We'll redact that. We won't add that to the final edit, you know? Yeah.
I love whippets though. Yeah, take that out too.
Yeah.
It's really that.
I mean, you can go ahead and get the whippet out. That way we ain't got to bring it back up again. If you want to just say some more about whippets, and we'll just knock that whole thing out. So we won't have no more whippet interruptions. You know?
I'm set. I'm good.
You good? Okay, you good. Okay. Okay. So
God, I love whippets.
Okay.
God, I love
them. Yeah, all right.
All set.
We're good?
I love them.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. I'm going to ask my final question as a monologue.
Please.
To see if I have potential.
Oh, yes. I love
it. It's going to be a question for you to answer, but I'm going to ask it as if I'm giving a monologue. Mm. And I want you to first let me know how good it was. If it was bad, don't say nothing. But let me know how good it was. And then answer the question.
Okay.
As is. If that's okay.
I love that.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I would like to know if there is any, and I mean any, inspirational words you would like to give to the audience to show that you, sir, that you believe anybody can do this job and do it well if given the right tools.
Well, first of all, on your performance,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to say just take that up about 10 notches in terms of volume.
It was still too low.
In terms of volume.
Still too low.
But okay. Otherwise, great.
Thank you.
And in terms of inspiration, what tools do we need? A microphone, an amp.
Okay. Before you finish, yeah. just to add a little bit more to the question,
yeah.
I didn't mean physical tools.
Oh,
I mean, like far as like tools and far as like
in
the ability to coach and do monologues properly. That's my fault.
Yeah, yeah. What you need is a sense that you don't respect the text as it currently exists,
mm-hmm.
and a willingness to change it, a willingness to say, well, I think we could just riff and come up with something better than whoever wrote this, you know, took, you know, however many years and however many revisions and drafts, however many people had eyes and hands on this. We could do something better in about 5 minutes. If you have that kind of mindset, that kind of just blind, nasty confidence, absolutely filth level confidence, I think you could absolutely do what I do.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We have James here, and he was the monologue coach. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for joining us.
Appreciate it.
This has been a blast.
This is the Novelizer signing off from the Caveat in New York City.
Thank you, Kevin and James. We appreciate it. At least I do. I can't speak for Steven, who's probably an ingrate, for all I know.
I appreciate it a little bit. No, see? A lot. I appreciate see? It a lot.
Fine.
So appreciate.
Now you're just saying that. Anus.
I don't think I've ever been called an anus before.
Well, get used to it. Get used to it. Because as long as I'm around, it's going to keep happening.
All right. I like this new dynamic.
Yeah. I've had a lot of caffeine today, and I'm just...
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's our show. It says thanks to my guests, but it's really our guests. Thanks to mine and the anus's guests. That's Steven Levinson. Thanks to our guests, Paul Scheer, Andrew Lynn, and James Dwyer. Come back next week for an episode with Baywatch's John Bass. Excuse me, that's the same show Baywatch's Pamela Anderson was on.
Amazing.
I mean, probably a new version, but...
I think it's a new version. But they probably hang out all the time.
Ugh, can you imagine? The Novelizers is hosted by me, Dave Hill, with Steven Levinson, and produced by Steven, Dennis DiClaudio, Cole Emhoff, Graham Douglas, Kevin Carter, Christine Bolin, Rob Kuttner, and Marla Ratner, and distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. Editing and mixing by Graham Douglas. Music by Cole Emhoff. Theme song by Andrew Lynn, recorded by Knotts. Additional editing by Andrew Lynn and Sunita Haberlein. Special thanks to Brad Combs and Parabolic Studio in Manhattan. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram and support us on Patreon. The Novelizers is written and recorded without the use of AI. The Novelizers is an unauthorized work of parody. Copyright 2025, Novelizers, LLC.